Hey, folks. My name is Dr. Amy Perlman. I'm a board-certified urologist with expertise in sexual, hormonal, and genitourinary health. And welcome to today's episode of Pearls and Perspectives. I have a very special guest with us today, Dr. Dan Sperling. Dan, say hello to the crew.
Hi, thanks for having me, Amy. Appreciate it. It's really nice to be here and talk about some prostate MRI and focal therapy.
Yeah, let's do it. So Dr. Sperling and I initially connected because when I was working at the University of Iowa, I had a patient there, and this guy is one of those guys that does his research. And he was diagnosed with prostate cancer. He was looking all over the country for people who were really leading the charge when it came to prostate cancer care. He signed up for Dr. Sperling's newsletters. He absolutely loved Dr. Sperling's newsletters and would forward them all to me. So when I moved down to the Miami, Florida area, he kept forwarding me those newsletters, and I saw that your office, Dr. Sperling, was not too far away from mine. And I knew I immediately had to connect with you. And here we are. Now we share a couple of mutual patients, and we're going to chit-chat today.
Yeah, it worked out very well that you're nearby. We can collaborate and go over some of these topics today.
Absolutely. So you're trained as a radiologist. Can you please begin by giving the viewers a little bit of a background on your training and expertise?
Yeah, I'm board certified in diagnostic radiology, and I work in interventional radiology and interventional MRI. So I did a residency in radiology, two fellowships. And in terms of prostate, I kind of fell into it when I had a diagnostic imaging center years ago, and there was a huge, large urology group I worked with.
So when you were working with that large urology group, tell me about how that collaboration was working.
Sure. I mean, we had actually a PET scanner at the time. It was years ago, and there was only FDG of fluorodeoxyglucose PET CT scans available. We were actually even doing Prostascent, which was an older method of evaluating for prostate cancer, which really weren't that effective. It was frustrating because there really weren't that many options available for prostate imaging. Biopsies were being done with just the truss biopsy at the time. And the urologist I was working with had a lot of frustration with really not having anything equivalent to a lot of the other cancers at the time that were FDG was effective for in terms of diagnosis. So I was always looking for a new solution or something that could be more effective and more accurate.
So is that how you got into the focal therapy space?
Yes. So I work with the urologists that were in the group with me. And we were looking internationally for any other solutions. The United States didn't really have anything at the time. And I found in Europe a group that was using MRI for multiparametric MRI. And they were actually biopsying inside the MRI machine, known as in-bore biopsy. And that's kind of how I got turned on to this. I worked a lot with those and collaborated with the group in Europe. And we published together. And at the we found that really the MPMRI was excellent at picking up prostate tumors in terms of localizing them. The specificity and sensitivity were excellent. And the biopsy inside the MRI, although at the time it took a very long amount, it took a tremendous amount of time to do, was very, very effective. And that's really how we fell into this. And we started incorporating a lot of those technologies in the United States and started using them.
So can you talk to me about the infrastructure that's involved in doing a biopsy inside of an MRI machine?
Sure. So with you first, of course, perform an MPMRI with AI, which we can talk about. You localize where the tumor tissue is. And then inside the MRI, you're putting the patient, instead of a supine position where they're lying on their back, they lie prone. There's a device that you've used from Philips, which has a needle guide that gets inserted into the rectum. And then you localize with the MRI guidance, you localize and position the needle guide, which is hollow, in the position of the tumor tissue. And once you're in the right trajectory, you insert the biopsy gun in through that needle guide, and then you sample. And you have actually MRI guidance and imaging to make sure you're accurate, you're within the tumor, and directly within the middle of the tumor instead of even laterally to the sides of the tumor to get a really accurate sampling. There are many different methods to do this. You can use the device from Philips to localize. There's a device from Europe that has a robotic component, which I have as well. So you can actually just point to the where you want to go and it moves automatically now. So that's quicker. It uses a pneumatic component. So you're able to use it within the MRI safely, and it's made of plastic and the pneumatic devices is brilliant technology. But those are really the two main methods you could use if you're doing the biopsy in-bore or inside the MRI machine.
So where did you learn most of these techniques? Was it self-taught? You kind of explored, you learned from people in Europe? How did that come about?
So I got started working with the groups in Europe, but I started, it was very, very much in its infancy stage. And then I advanced it on my own by using it and continuing to improve upon what was already being used in Europe and going beyond that.
So what's been the feedback? Because I know it's challenging to be on the cutting edge of medicine. So especially when you were starting out offering these innovative approaches, like what were people saying?
Years and years ago, when I was doing just starting out with MPMRI, there was a lot of pushback from all types of doctors in different specialties that MRI was useless. There was no point in using MRI for targeting. At the time, one of my close friends was a urologist running one of the largest urology groups in the country. He was laughing at me. What, this is pointless. And the patients got pushback from the urologist when they went back to them. And now, lo and behold, today it's widely used and very accepted. And it's part of the standard of care for diagnosing prostate cancer. And it's really incredible it's amazing how things have really evolved.
I know. It's like medicine is so slow and yet quick to evolve, right? It's kind of like you get both at the same time. But I remember even during my training, I was training during residency from 2012 until 2017. And for the most part, we were still doing like standard, truss biopsies at that time. And now whenever I see patients in my clinic, I don't currently do biopsies on the prostate, but I tell my patients, you need to see someone who's doing like MRI-guided biopsies. And there still are a lot of urologists that aren't. What's the barrier? Is the barrier the infrastructure and the learning curve? What's the pushback now?
Like you said, Amy, you're young and you...
Oh, thanks, Dad.
So... No, but if you think about doing residency, you weren't trained in it, right? And there's still a lot of urology residency programs that aren't training their trainees in this. But in terms of the beauty of with MRI guidance, or what really was fantastic that happened, and I was involved in that, was MRI ultrasound fusion, where it allowed the urologist inside their office to be able to get the advantages of MRI and fuse the MRI image with ultrasound and do targeting. And now you're seeing MRI ultrasound fusion all over the country and being widely used. And that was a real game changer. And that's another thing. I used to go to a lot of urology offices and we were talking about creating different programs with MRI ultrasound fusion. But it was too early because a lot of the urologists at the time hadn't yet bought into MRI being used for prostate imaging. But there's been a tremendous, tremendous evolution of this. And obviously, as everyone knows, it's being widely used. So the MRI ultrasound fusion is far superior to any either cognitive co-registrations, and people will do a truss biopsy, but look at the MRI and look at the report and they go target. The MRI ultrasound fusion is a huge step above that and has very good results as well. And it makes it cost effective, right? If you can do it in your office or in a surgical center, the urologists, of course, now are more likely to use it. It's more accessible as opposed to, I used to have urologists that would come to me to do one or two biopsies, I did the in-bore biopsy, but it just wasn't feasible to get access to an MRI machine and to do those.
So you have a clinic, Sperling Prostate Center, and you're in the Delray, Florida area, and you have patients coming in from what, all over the world to see you?
Yeah, I have patients coming in from all over, and they seek it out. They seek out. They do a lot of research and or a lot of it's word of mouth, or have a lot of doctors that other referring doctors to send patients. So it's a mix. And yeah, they come from all over and they're seeking out the most advanced MRI technology for detection and then for targeting, biopsy, and then for treatment.
I think your patients are probably some of the smartest patients that enter the healthcare system and have gone down a lot of the rabbit holes. What are they looking for when they see someone like you?
So you made a good point. I mean, I would say when I got started in this years ago, 90% of my patients were engineers. So they really had a good grasp of newer technology and were more open to it. But in terms of what are they looking for? People want to know that they're being diagnosed properly. They want to know that they're not being, in terms of getting a truss, that it's just not like a pin the tail on the donkey approach. They really want to know that the tumor itself is being targeted accurately. They're also looking for limited sampling. They don't want the same tremendous, some people, it's not just a random where you're doing 12 samples. Some people go way beyond that. And the beauty of MRI, either with in-bore MRI biopsy or MRI ultrasound fusion, is you don't have to do as many samples. You could still do the randoms and the targeting, but not to the same volume. So they really want the right diagnosis. That's what's important to them with a limited amount of side effects.
And let's talk about the limited amount of side effects. What have you seen with your technologies and the side effects, maybe compared to some other therapies we use for prostate cancer?
Well, on the diagnostic side, I went biopsy. If you're limiting the amount of sampling, and I do the MRI transrectal biopsy transrectally and transperineally, you're limiting the amount of insertions with the transrectal approach. The transperineal, obviously, you're going to limit risk of infection, limit bleeding, and things like that. So it is a lot better tolerated and a lot safer.
Mm-hmm. And then what about, though, with your treatment options? Because you offer a couple of different treatment options for actually treating low to intermediate risk prostate cancer. So the guys who seek you out, I know they're looking, they don't want to leak urine and they don't want to have changes in their erectile function. What do they tell you when they're in clinic with you?
So a lot of them are concerned that a lot of them have friends or family that have had the radical prostatectomy or have undergone radiation. They're concerned about incontinence, erectile dysfunction, their quality of life is very important to them and paramount. And they're looking for the best solution, something that a way to treat their cancer, minimizing side effects, but also minimizing recurrence. So it's a balance. They understand that these types of focal therapies are newer compared to, mostly newer compared to surgery or radiation. Cryotherapy has been around a lot longer, but is associated with some more side effects in a lot of cases. But they are seeking out the best option or solution, and it's very variable. It depends on the patient. It depends what they prioritize. Someone who prioritizes quality of life will seek out these types of treatments. Someone who wants to know they took the most established approach and will actually seek out surgery or radiation and get a whole gland treatment.
So you offer a couple of different focal therapy options. Focal laser therapy, MR targeted focus ultrasound, and TULSA, which is transurethral ultrasound ablation of the prostate. So three different treatment options for low to intermediate risk prostate cancer. How do you decide which one you're going to use for a patient?
So a couple of things go into factor into that decision-making. Number one, is a tumor, when you do the TULSA Pro, which is transurethral ultrasound ablation, you've got to have a prostate gland that, just similar to standard HIFU, you need a prostate that does not have a lot of calcifications. You need to have a CT scan that evaluates for calcium. Calcium will block the ultrasound beam and limit the amount of heat that you can administer. You also need to have a certain distance. You've got to measure the distance from the urethra and make sure that the beam from the ultrasound can effectively reach the tumor tissue. So if you've got a larger prostate gland and you've got a tumor in the peripheral zone, sometimes it's just not an option. But the TULSA Pro and the TULSA Pro in general tends to be a very, very good treatment for very large volumes. It's very efficient and quick at ablating large amounts of prostate tissue. So if you have a more aggressive case, or if you have a tumor in the transition zone, and sometimes even the peripheral zone, it's an excellent treatment for those patients. In terms of laser ablation, you're doing a smaller ablation. It's more precise and more focal. So if the case is more localized or closer to the neurovascular bundle, and then sometimes even the transition zone, it's a very good option. The transition zone, some tumors are also not well treated with the transurethral ultrasound approach. The laser fiber is inserted directly into the tumor tissue. It almost skewers it and then heats very effectively from within the tumor itself. So a lot of it has to do with the Gleason grade, if it's a Decipher, genomic analysis, the volume, positioning of the tumor, if it's near the neurovascular bundle, closer to the apex, the external urethral sphincter, those all come into play in terms of which is the best option.
So how often would calcification within someone's prostate notice on CT scan preclude you from offering the TULSA? Is that a pretty common thing?
It's not so common, but, you know, there's a subset of patients where it is a problem. And, you know, calcifications occur from a variety of causes. And some people have no idea, obviously. Well, no one knows they have them, but they do pop up in people, and we've got to be very selective in who we choose to do that at.
Okay, so let's talk about the actual procedures. Like, patient comes in. Typically, how long does like the setup take for these procedures? How long does the actual procedure take? And what happens afterwards? And what type of anesthesia are you using?
So for the Tulsa Pro, we're using conscious sedation with anesthesiologist. Obviously, you're using a probe that's going transurethrally, and they're lying supine for it. That procedure itself, the setup, could take about 40 minutes, an hour to do sometimes. The procedure, duration of the procedure, the actual ablation time will typically be somewhere in the range of 45 minutes to an hour or so, depending on the case. Obviously, it's a much larger gland, then that will take a lot longer. With laser ablation, the setup's a little quicker. You're talking about 15 to 20 minutes. The actual procedure time could be anywhere between an hour and a half or so to 2 hours, all together with the entire, everything included. Now, with both procedures, you're doing a diagnostic scan ahead of time for planning purposes for both the Tulsa Pro and the laser ablation, and then you're giving contrast afterwards to assess the effects. So all that adds up. MRI is on a CT scanner, and so the imaging time adds in takes up a lot of the time of the procedure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so patient gets a procedure done. Are they leaving the same day?
Yes. There's no overnight stay. Mm-hmm. After treatment, we'll keep them here for about 30 minutes, an hour. If they're under anesthesia, obviously we wait a little bit longer. And then they're able to go. They're discharged after the procedure is completed.
Okay. And then what are some of the short-term symptoms that people might experience after these procedures? So do they go home with a catheter?
Yes. I routinely use a catheter. With laser, we use it to cool the urethra during the procedure and protect the urethral tissue. In terms of the Tulsa Pro, I still even use a catheter after that because of the swelling that occurs. You don't want to do under tension the several days after the procedure. So the catheter stays in for about a week on average. It could be longer depending on how much swelling there is, which you can see on the post-contrast imaging.
So do they initially have some irritative symptoms? Would that be a common thing that someone describes?
Yeah, there's some people have, not everybody, but some will have irritative symptoms afterwards. A lot of it's really just adjusting to having a catheter in, that most people are uncomfortable with that. But once the catheter is removed, the irritative symptoms really are pretty mild, and they're urinating comfortably, and they feel pretty good afterwards. They feel, most guys, even with the catheter in, within 24 hours, feel like they're mostly back to themselves.
Mm-hmm. So these therapies are killing the tumor in real time. It's not like you do it and then like over the next few weeks, it's still killing the tumor. Like, how does that actually work?
So with both technologies, we're using something called MRI thermometry with real-time temperature mapping, and the ablation occurs in real time, but there is an increase in what we see post-contrast. There's studies have been done with these technologies after treatment, and you can even see about a 20% increase in size of the ablation zone several weeks out from the treatment. So that there is that progressive necrotic tissue that develops over time.
Okay. And then when do you repeat the MRI once the treatment's performed?
So usually we repeat the MRI about 6 to 8 months after the procedure. There is a lot of inflammation, and that change post-treatment takes a while to resolve. You don't want to have false positives on the MRI, so you've got to give it time to some degree to heal. And then within that time frame, we get a good idea if there's any type of recurrence, and we use the accepted methodologies for analysis post-treatment, which are different, obviously, than a treatment-naive or a patient that's never had treatment before.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you get that MRI 6 to 8 months later, and then how often do you repeat the MRI and follow up?
So usually, we repeat the PSA indefinitely every 6 months, and an MRI is done after that first initial follow-up. We do it yearly after that, 1 year to year and a half.
Okay, so what would we expect? Like, how do we compare or define PSA recurrence after focal prostate cancer therapy? Would it be the same as with radiation where you get the nadir and then you add two?
So No, because we're not doing a whole gland treatment. There's a lot of prostatic tissue that's still left. They'll still have some PSA. A very valuable metric is the PSA density, which we use. And you're looking at, and this is, every case is different, but you're looking at about a 0.12 PSA density cutoff for rebiopsying. If there's an, including if there's an MRI abnormality, that comes into play too. But yes, you're looking at, you're not looking at a PSA of, you know, zero or a little bit higher, like you would see with radiation, and definitely not with, compared to surgery. It's very different.
So for, let's say, your patients that are following up then with their local urologist, like they, we need to all know this information. I mean, I'm not currently in the prostate cancer world, so obviously that's why I was asking you about that. But is this well known about what we should expect with PSA recurrence after focal therapy?
I wouldn't say it's so well known, right? It's still new, and there's still and even there's still being research done on what are the, you know, the standard criteria. There's this target system for classifying tumors like the PI-RADS that's being used. There's a PI-FAB in Europe that was developed. There are all these scoring systems, but even radiologists are still learning and adapting to these follow-up methodologies and how to really, when is the right time to trigger a biopsy. But you can still use the PSA density and even the PSA velocity and other metrics that are used. But it definitely is not well-known, or there's still a learning curve occurring throughout the country with that, with terms of follow-up.
Yeah, and I think there's still certainly a lot of confusion and polarization and stigma related to focal therapy. Who do you think is like an ideal candidate for considering this?
Usually someone with a grade 2 prostate cancer. You can do grade 3, but you've got to be very selective of the case. You're looking at tumor volume. The ideal patient would be within a 1.5 centimeters of size of the tumor tissue. You're obviously going to look at the genomics and the DNA analysis as well. That plays a role. What I find really important, that I don't think is as used as it could be, is cribriform morphology, which is independent risk variable for disease progression. So that should play a role in deciding. So ideally, if they don't have cribriform, that's preferred. And you're looking for, if it's unilateral disease, that's preferable than bilateral, of course. So there are a whole bunch of variables that come into play. A lot of it's individualized, and you've also got to find the right person that's prioritizing quality of life with the newer technologies, as opposed to things that are more established, and maybe they're more comfortable doing surgery or radiation because they've been around a lot longer.
Yeah. Dr. Sperling, do you have patients that come in that are like really set on getting focal therapy, where you just know they're not a good candidate and you have to explain to, like, you have to talk them out of it? Does that happen pretty commonly?
Yes, it happens a lot. There are patients that even come in with at least 9 or 10 cancers, and they're begging me to do the case. And obviously, they're terrible candidates for it, and it's very hard for them. And I spend a while speaking to them, and it's tough, but it's just, it would be extremely dangerous and risky to treat someone who is not a good candidate.
Mm-hmm. So you had mentioned that you've done some research in this area. What have you learned from the research that you've done that you want urologists to know? What are some of the key points there?
Well, the key points are patient selection is critical. That's really what it comes down to. You've got to find the right, like we discussed just previously, the right Gleason grade. You got to look at the genomics. You got to do a very thorough workup. You've got to make sure that the volume is not too great. You don't want to have, you want to be careful about extracapsular or extraprostatic extension. And you've got to really use all the imaging available. Let's say there's something that's more, finding that's more equivocal. You shouldn't hesitate to use a PSMA PET CT when needed. The AI, artificial intelligence nowadays, is really incredible. And it just keeps getting better every day. That really plays a huge role. It's helped me a lot in terms of figuring out who is the best candidate. There are people that have had MRIs done elsewhere that you would think on paper look fantastic in terms of candidates for focal therapy. And I'll find with the AI signal in the seminal vesicles that was not able to be seen with standard MRI. The AI is really becoming a very, very powerful tool in the arsenal of evaluating for candidates for focal therapy.
Yeah, so let's delve into that. I love talking about the use of AI. So how is it useful in your practice? How are you using it?
So I try to use two or three different artificial intelligence systems because, you know, they all use very different methodologies, or I try to use ones that actually do. So then when I compare and their similarities or differences, it really tells you a lot about the case. There's one that I really like, or two of them, but one that is, they're very different. There's one from Cortex.ai. It's called Restriction Spectrum Imaging. And what that allows you to do is it differentiates between abnormalities with diffusion-weighted restriction, the key element or key tool we use in MRI imaging. So it allows you to look for diffusion-weighted abnormalities that are benign versus ones that are actual cancer. And it has a very good color map, and you can map out changes. In fact, this is still in the early stages, but I'll look at that even post-treatment, and it's very valuable. A lot more research needs to be done on it, but it can actually differentiate from scar versus tumor tissue. What happens is post-treatment, is that scar, and it becomes more challenging to find recurrence. We rely, and according to all the newer classification systems, we use DCE or dynamic contrast enhancement. That's our main tool in looking for blood flow patterns to differentiate if there's tumor. But even now with the AI, I'm seeing the beginnings of potentially using that as a very valuable tool to look for recurrence. So RSI is very good. The other one, I think there's another company called Prostate ID. It's fantastic. It's got very good detection capabilities. It gives you a very nice three-dimensional map of the gland with the tumor, which is nice to be able to share with patients, and she actually they can see it and really visualize it better. So that's a very, very valuable tool. And there's a couple other systems I've been experimenting with that I believe we'll use in the future as well that have even more potential features that they could offer to kind of complement the other ones.
So what are you hoping that AI will be able to do for you in the future that it currently isn't?
It will continue to really prevent false positives with biopsy and then more accurately target the tumor, the index lesion, and then the satellite or other lesions. It'll give us a better, in terms of detection, a better way to classify, making sure that you can sample directly within the tumor tissue as opposed to peripherally where you may get a lower Gleason score. And for recurrence, like I mentioned, it's going to be fantastic. I believe in the future it'll be a fantastic tool to evaluate for any recurrence post-focal therapy.
So, are you actively training the AI?
The AI itself is every study I do gets processed back into anonymized and processed back into their system, and I keep learning from it myself and tremendous volume coming in from centers from all over the country and internationally. So the AI is continually improving and at a very rapid rate. I mean, the accuracy, you know, you continue to see it. It just really, really improves as the MRI imaging improves as well. And MRI systems themselves are incorporating AI to accelerate the speed or speed up the actual MRI time and the resolution. Altogether, it's really going to revolutionize the whole space.
Yeah. You know, I was talking to a radiologist. This was like several years ago. And when he was really doing a lot of prostate MRI, he was working with urologists in the community. And there was oftentimes this feedback of what was coming back positive, what did the surgical pathology show? And so he was able to, you know, change his technique in real time in terms of what he was calling on the MRI. This seems like a way more sophisticated way, right, of collaborating with kind of the urologist or other people on the team.
Absolutely. In terms of, I've been working with some of these companies to make the AI available to the urologist, the ones using MRI ultrasound fusion. It really makes it a lot easier. It's hard enough to do the planning and the co-registration, but this really allows them to more easily localize the tumor and use it the same way I am in terms of stratifying the patients who need biopsies versus not, and then at doing more accurate targeting. It's just a game changer all around. So for that, and then some of the focal therapy companies are incorporating AI, they're working on incorporating AI into their actual planning for the focal therapy treatment.
So, Dr. Sperling, most of the people watching this episode are going to be practicing urologists, and we don't live in an ideal world. But if we did, just play along for a second, what would your message be to other urologists about the ideal way for specialists like you to collaborate with practicing urologists?
So I think that I've seen throughout the country, it's been amazing to see the collaboration between the radiologists, the urologists, the radiologists on the diagnostic side, the urologists really treating and managing prostate cancer patients. I'm kind of like a unicorn. I don't foresee a lot of other radiologists doing what I do. I just happen to be in the right place at the right time for a while with a lot of excellent urologists. And I've been very fortunate to work with amazing urologists throughout the country and collaborate with them. So I would say I do see urologists really, it's becoming a lot more widely accepted focal therapy. There's a ways to go. I think being open-minded and following a lot of the latest literature that comes out would be very helpful. And then really closely working and meeting in person sometimes the radiologist, because the urologists, I've seen a lot of them that can read the MRI at a very high level. They're developing a lot of the expertise, and the more they work with the local, their local radiologist and have a back and forth and give the radiologist feedback on their biopsies or their focal therapy, the better the radiologist will get. So I've seen a lot of guys really develop those strong relationships, and it helps both sides. Everybody can do a better job and have a more efficient or effective team.
Yeah. And, you know, the first thing that I did once I connected with you is I said, I want to come to your office and check it out. And I was just amazed at all the technology you have. And it's a beautiful office. So let's finish up this episode. I'm going to ask you two rapid fire questions. So the first one coming at you, what's one thing every man with newly diagnosed prostate cancer should ask about focal therapy?
So they first want to ask themselves, what do I want? A technology where it's quality of life, something that I prioritize? They have to kind of weigh a lot of what is very important to them. And they have to understand the way in that focal therapy still is in, it's been around now for a while, but it's still in the earlier stages relative to surgery or radiation. They really need to evaluate that, and then they need to really focus on getting the right diagnosis. They need to go for an MP MRI, try to get one with artificial intelligence. That makes a tremendous difference. In terms of the workup of the biopsy, they want at least some type of MRI-guided biopsy, whether it's MRI-guided ultrasound fusion biopsy or with in-bore biopsy. That's critical to really getting the most effective to get the most effective workup, the best workup, and the most accurate diagnosis. Genomic testing now plays a really incredible role. It's a real game changer as well. Things score, the Decipher score, other tests like that, that really is important as well in terms of deciding if they're even candidates for focal therapy, and just to see working with their doctors to get the most accurate diagnosis, staging. That's really key in terms of them making a decision if focal therapy is even something to consider. But the MRI guidance in terms of biopsy is extremely important as well.
Wow. I'm amazed at how much prostate cancer has evolved over the last 10 to 15 years. It blows my mind. All right. Second rapid fire question for you, Dr. Sperling. What's one of the biggest misconceptions about focal therapy?
A lot of times people think with focal therapy that they don't, first of all, there's across the country, there's a lot of heterogeneity. A lot of some people are more aware of it. They follow the research. Some people don't know how far along it's come. And I think, really keeping track of some of the studies, the literature, patients will be asking doctors about it. It's really important to stay up to date with the treatments, which ones could be potential options for their patients. That's really, really what I would say is the biggest or most important thing people could do. In terms of incorporating MRI into someone's practice and then following different MRI ultrasound fusion developments, the genomics and some of the pathology findings, and really making sure you've got a full arsenal of different diagnostic and treatment methods that are accessible to you, and then finding the right practitioners that you could work with to really put that into play and give your patients the best care available.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Sperling, thank you so much for sharing all this knowledge with us today. Any final messages for our listeners?
I would say that we're at a very, very exciting time. We've got the most advanced diagnostic imaging ever available with MRI and now with artificial intelligence. There are a lot of new focal therapy treatments that are available that have tremendous promise and can really offer people more options. On an active surveillance basis, we're seeing really fantastic ways to incorporate these methodologies to offering the best for patients for active surveillance. So we're a very exciting time, and I think we just got to keep the research coming and following it, and really great things are happening.
Where can people find out more information about your practice?
On my website, SperlingProstateCenter.com, and the phone number is there, and I'm happy to talk to anyone or any collaborate in any way. That I would say that's the best way.
Awesome. Dr. Sperling, thank you so much for joining us today on today's episode of Pearls and Perspectives.
Thank you, Amy. I appreciate being able to be on your podcast, and it was very nice. Thanks.
Until next time.